Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
How was your baking this evening?
We had a good bake.
Oh, good.
We had a good bake. We already have Easter on the radar, so things
uh-huh.
like hot cross buns and all that kind of stuff are happening.
Oh, boy.
So
was it a heavy bake or a...
For a Saturday, well, I'll put it this way. We got here at 3:45, and Frank went home already, and if you and I weren't talking, I'd be going home, too.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's also a reflection of the, just, you know... pretty good efficiency, so we try to get 8 hours worth of work done in, you know, 7 hours.
Excellent.
And you said you baked today.
Well, actually, I'm just putting some loaves together. I'm doing a little bit of everybody's bread, and, you know, just something that I can have with my cheese at home. So and today we are talking to Jeffrey Hamelman of King Arthur Bakery. Well, my first question would be, why baking?
The easy answer, the short answer, of course, would be, why not? But a little bit more elaborate answer, I guess what would come to my mind would be, I think Thomas Jefferson said, you know, we should all be public servants one way or the other. And he didn't take money to be president. And eventually he was almost broke. I think the Library of Congress was founded on the sale of Jefferson's library. So here's a guy who wouldn't take money because he felt like he had to serve his country. And maybe that's true. We all need to be public servants in one way or another. I think most of the people in Congress are probably not really in that category of public servants, but I would certainly say a baker's in that category. And for my own personal baking life, that was to be able to work manually and to work with obscurity and to produce things that gave nourishment and pleasure were all really important. And I started 30 years ago, and those values remain important.
What was it that enticed you into the craft? Was it the bread itself or the ritual of the bread baking?
No, it didn't have anything to do with ritual. I had been... farming for a few years in western Massachusetts. I was trying to farm organically in the early 70s, and the word wasn't quite in the dictionary. I was going to save the world with green soybeans and bicycles, I thought, and so far it hasn't worked. And I did that, and I loved the work very much. It wasn't really successful financially, but it was very rewarding internally to me. And then while I was in that phase of work, I met a woman, a German woman, who had started a bakery in Northampton, Massachusetts, and her products were just extraordinary. I'd never seen anything like that, and her breads and pastries were remarkable, and I gradually, slowly got to know her and asked her if I could work for her. She wouldn't let me. She said I was an American, and Americans couldn't bake. And I asked her repeatedly over the course of several months and finally wore down her considerable Teutonic resistance, and she hired me, and she assured me that it would be really entry level and bottom of the pyramid, and I was more than happy to be there. And I started working for her. So it didn't have anything to do with the ritual. I think if you bake for your livelihood, you probably don't focus as much on sort of the ritualistic end of things as you would if you were just making a couple loaves of bread on the weekend.
Did bread in itself as a product entice you, or was it just, you know, I mean, living good, the healthy life? I mean, people now, I think, are trying to kind of go back to that. I mean, at least for myself, as a home baker, I talk to a lot of home bakers and, you know, professionals about baking, and what is it that really draws you in? What is it in the cycle of bread baking?
Bread very much enticed me when I started and continues to entice me for a lot of reasons. One, because we are making things that do provide nourishment. We're making things that require our full senses to be engaged at all times. We're making things that the environment of the bread dough always has subtle variations in the needs each day. And that doesn't change if you're working for 2 loaves at home or if you're working for 1,000 loaves on a daily basis in production. It's still, the needs have slight variation. So that's very appealing. It's also very enticing to know that we can be united or somehow connected, not just with colleagues around the world who are baking at that very moment, but also we are links in this very long chain of bakers who go back for, of course, thousands of years. And there's something that for somebody like me, I felt very, very kind of secure and confident knowing that I was embarking on work that had this really long lineage, and I was just sort of the latest manifestation of that lineage.
Historically, bread baking, I guess, was an accident or an experiment by those Neolithic creatures walking around the earth. And what's the connection with that early and humble beginning to what we call artisan baking today, if there is any?
Well, I guess the early and humble, we'll never sort out what came first. Was it crude, fermented alcoholic drinks? There's some evidence that people would have just sort of chewed on wild grains, and the enzymes in our mouth might have started a fermentation going on, and they might have discovered very crude alcoholic drinks at a very, very early time, maybe predating bread, who knows. And then there's the whole theory about the flatbreads that one fine day in Egypt, somebody left it out and didn't want to throw it out tomorrow, so they baked it and it rose, and so here was the beginnings of leavened bread. That's all kind of misty prehistory. I don't really know how that would relate to today's artisan bread. I guess when I think today about really well-made breads, what they have in common with well-made breads of, 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago is, a respect for the ingredients and either an intuitive or an academic or both understanding of the whole mechanism of the process of bread baking and things like that. Arguably, the breads that we're able to make today, the finest breads that we can make today, possibly are better than the finest breads that were made at any other time in history. I don't know because I haven't eaten any bread since I was born, but perhaps we're able to do that now in a way that other generations couldn't do because we do have flour that's much more reliable. We do have milling technology that's much more sophisticated, and so on and so forth. Not to denigrate what was possible to earlier bakers, but I think maybe in terms of broad consistency of really first-class bread, we might be in a slightly better condition now than previously.
And is there a definition that you would use for an artisan baker today? Because it's pretty much a loose term these days and kind of maybe just a selling point to sell a loaf of bread, because I've seen some pretty ugly breads that are quote-unquote artisan or something.
Oh, yes. Put a little flour on the surface, call it artisan, and charge an extra dollar. That seems to be one way that's unfolding. I don't particularly care for the term artisan baker for a number of reasons. First of all, it might not be etymologically accurate in that, or shall I say artisan bread, because artisan pertains to a human. So you have an artisan who might be a mason, or you have an artisan who might be a potter or whatever. And I think a baker is an artisan who works with his hands, uses his hands, creates a product from scratch, all those things that go into kind of the historical concept of what an artisan is. But we must be very careful using that term because it doesn't necessarily imply, but it seems to often imply that one who is not an artisan baker is somehow less of a baker. And in my experience, I've seen plenty of old-time bakers who are making products that might not be considered artisan products by a new generation of bakers, but who have skills and experience and understanding that is really, really remarkable. And I don't know why they shouldn't be in the club. To me, the word baker is a really firm, sturdy, proud, historical word, and I don't need any adjectives. Just call me a baker. I don't really need to be called an artisan baker at all.
You said before that you're not looking for fame or anything like that. And in the cooking world, I think people are seeking that fame and fortune. So bakers are a distinct sort of animal in itself. It's an oh, it's a thankless sort of job with horrible hours, but there's something really unique about baking at night by yourself or with others.
Yeah, it's not thankless. It's definitely not thankless. I mean, bakers are really upstanding and very, very important members of their community. Maybe I'm romanticizing it a little bit, but I think that is pretty much the case for bakers who have the good fortune to be baking for a community. I think if we're working in a windowless factory for 8 hours through the night, just simply shaping bread or just simply mixing bread and not seeing any other facet of the production, that could feel thankless. But I think if we're able to have a job that incorporates the entire production of bread from, you know, building your sourdough right through the mix and the shaping and the baking, that puts you in a different context to things, a slightly different relationship, because you're part of the entire production in that scenario, and I think that gives you a different inner sense of what your connection is to things.
Bread is basically water, leaven, salt, flour. And I probably got the order wrong there, but the baker manipulates the flavors of the bread by, you know, harnessing the living product. And how do the – what's a really small term or way you could explain that, harnessing of the product?
You're right about that. I guess I use the word alchemist more than artisan. I think a baker is really an alchemist, because if I were to give – you a bag of flour right now and said, go ahead, eat it. It's really yummy. Obviously, it wouldn't nourish us. It wouldn't sustain us, and we couldn't live eating flour. So there is something that happens through the involvement of the baker where you're taking this set of ingredients that will not sustain life, and once the baker has gone through the process of making the bread, look what we have on the other end. We have something that's nourishing. And so what is this mysterious thing? We're lucky that we are involved in the kind of work where human involvement is necessary, and we connect ourselves to this kind of fundamental process of nature. We don't ferment the flour, but we direct the fermentation of the flour. We, in a sense, don't bake the bread. We require fire or a heat source to bake the bread, but we direct the baking of the bread. And so we're taking these random ingredients that won't sustain life, and through our care and skill and experience, we direct things to the outcome that we hope we will get. And there's an act of faith involved with that, because once you consign things to the oven, in a sense, things are out of your hand. So we're always very deeply connected with the present tense, because, you know, the oven is doing its thing here, and we've got to be totally keyed in on what today's oven situation is. I'm not explaining that very well.
No, I understood. I mean, I guess most people who listen to this will have the sort of idea of what you're talking about. But I my father was a painter, so I kind of look as cooks as painters, using a palette and canvas, that being the plate and the product. And bakers, I was thinking about this. I said, what are bakers? Are they musicians? Are they changing notes and tempo? Is that what you would use as a metaphor?
Bakers have a very limited palette, or a limited number of notes that can be played, unlike cooks who have a fairly unlimited number of ingredients they can pull from. But bakers don't have that. So bakers have the wonderful opportunity every day to try to perfect things that were worked out hundreds and hundreds of years ago. This is a concept that my wife actually brought up in conversation one night. You know, the baker isn't inventing the next great dish, the next great combination of flavors. Bakers tend to be trying to perfect things every day that were already worked out prior to today. And to some people that could sound unbelievably boring, and to other people it could sound unbelievably exciting. And I think most people who really, really bake and love baking, they probably tend to find it pretty exciting.
I heard an interview that you did on the radio about hearing the sounds of the bread in the mixer and telling a baker to turn off the mixer because the dough was ready. How do you measure the skill of a baker? Is it by the finished product or dexterity or just generally everything in the repertoire?
How do you measure the skill of a baker? Well, did they show up to work on time? That's where you start measuring the skill. Punctuality, attitude towards fellow workers, attitude towards finished product, attitude towards the recipient of the finished product, respect for ingredients, respect for all those things we've inherited from the prior generations of bakers, all these things before even turning on a mixing bowl. And then, yeah, respect for the whole process of making bread, and then, of course, the actual skills of mixing and right through to the bake. So working cleanly, working with efficiency, working with understanding of things, working with a good, positive relationship to the fact that we are really in an honored position to be able to be baking for other people. It's a very important role, and it shouldn't be minimized. It's not drudgery at all. It's a very, very important role that demands a lot of skill. It demands a lot of intelligence, good retention of lots of random bits of information, lots of hand and eye coordination. And again, you're pretty much involved in all five senses. So when I talked about telling that young newcomer to turn off the mixer because the dough is mixed, and I was standing around the corner, and he's saying, he can see around the corner? But I knew, just because I had been baking long enough to know that there's a certain sound quality that would come when the dough had developed to the correct point in the mixing bowl. He didn't know that. He had no context. But if you're around these things often enough, then all of your senses pick up these very subtle learnings, and then we can use them. So in a sense, it's not that we're on autopilot, but in a sense, a lot of times our minds can be almost suspended because it's our other senses that are really involved with, you know, when the dough is ready to divide, when the dough is ready to shape, when the dough is perfect for the oven. It's not so much an intellectual consideration. It's a consideration of your eyes, your hands, oftentimes your ears. And so your mind is somewhat exempt from the whole proceeding.
Yeah, and you have to be kind of managing all these different things that are alive and going all at once. Lionel Paulin had a concept of retro-innovation by combining traditional methods with modern development. Do you think that's a good formula for today's bakery?
I think for me, it's immensely important that we uphold the highest standards that we can. And to me, that means upholding tradition and at the same time evolving. These are not mutually exclusive. We can uphold tradition and evolve at the same time, and I think we need to be able to do that so that we can keep one foot connected to our lineage, if you will, and the other foot connected to the gradual evolution of the bread. Now, in a sense, Paulin was making bread that was formerly the kind of bread that people ate. So in a sense, he didn't come up with anything new. What was new was the fact that, wow, this is Paris. Wow, this is a really fashionable district in Paris. Wow, half the customers come in with a fur coat and high heels on and a poodle dog, so you don't know where the fur coat ends and the poodle dog begins. And these people are buying these kind of retro breads. So he didn't, like, invent a new bread, but he definitely modernized the whole production of it and the whole marketing of it. In no way am I saying that to denigrate his bread, because his bread was great. But he didn't invent that kind of bread.
Why do you think he wasn't making baguettes?
I don't know the answer to that. Certainly, a baguette's going to have a much lower life expectancy than one of his big miche loaves. So maybe that was part of the motivation. I don't know. Or maybe his whole self-image as the baker was that he was making these large miche loaves and other breads too, and that his reputation and livelihood were sufficient just based on that.
And if you were to say, I'm going to make a new formula, are most formulas based on what's been already done before, or can you really create a new formula for a bread?
Well, I'll give you a real-life example. We make here at the King Arthur Bakery, once a week we make a bread in a Pullman pan. It's 100% organic rye bread, and it's a sourdough bread, and it's really, really good. And we've got a good market for it here. It's one of these breads that you take a thin slice and do an open face this or that with it, and it'll keep for weeks. It's great stuff. So we've been making that for some time, and we're going through a period of time when we were having some of it left over, and we would sell it for 1 week because it does have a very good keeping quality, but we didn't want to sell it longer than that because we want the customers to have it for as long as possible. But we didn't want to throw it out. So one morning after lunch, I went into the office, and I came out 10 minutes later, and I said to one of the women who is a baker here, I said, let's try this next week. Basically, I had gone in and come up with a bread that used, 40% rye flour, 60% white flour, flaxseed that was soaked a day before the bake, a little yeast, a little salt, and a portion of the old 100% rye bread that we would also soak. So we were taking some of the old bread, soaking it, and then adding that into the new batch. So I could say, oh, man, how cool am I? You know, I just created, I developed this new bread. Or you could probably say what I did, which was, gee, I don't really want to look at that that 100% rye bread getting thrown out because it's too precious of a bread. So why don't I come up with a bread that incorporates the old bread, which is a time-honored tradition. And I didn't make anything up. I simply combined ingredients that go well together in the correct proportion. So I couldn't have said, yeah, we're going to use an equal weight of old bread with white flour. Well, we wouldn't be able to. That's out of the zone of what you can get by with. But I did know that, you know, if we did 40% rye, that's going to give us a nice tang. And if we had 1.3% yeast, we'll have enough leavening power. And maybe 10% flax would give us a nice nutty quality to it. And 8% of the old bread would give us a nice kind of basso continuo sort of kind of base note when we eat the bread. And so I was just combining ingredients that are well known to go well together. I haven't made anything up. I'm sure there's a lot of bakers who feel they have. I haven't made up a darn thing. I've kind of just been a conduit between all the prior generations of bakers, and then, you know, a lot of stuff gets funneled through you by meeting other people and baking with them or reading a book here or there, and then you just kind of turn around and put it out the other side for other people to benefit from, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Bread shapes and vocabulary are kind of intertwined historically with religious and sexual symbols like miche or hot cross buns or bread in the oven. Is that because bakers are kind of a bawdy and rambunctious crowd, or is there something really behind that historical, those references or names?
I would say historically bakers work like dogs for unbelievable number of hours doing physical labor that few of us would be capable of doing today. I don't think they had time to be bawdy. I think they were, I know, for example, in France in the 1700s, if you were an apprentice, you were required to be in your uniform X number of hours per day. You could not be out of your uniform. If you owned a bakery, you were required to be at this market for a minimum of these hours on these days with a minimum of this amount of bread every single time. And if you didn't comply, your oven was destroyed by the state. And if your oven was gone, so was your livelihood. I don't think bakers had time to be bawdy. I think the reason, perhaps, and I'm not an anthropologist, so I can't be too confident about what I'm saying, but it seems to me that the reason you have all these images that are associated with bread and sexuality or bread and religion might very well be because historically, in Europe, in any event, the vast majority of the population consumed little more than bread. So we get words in the vocabulary such as breadwinner. There's proverbs throughout Europe that pertain to bread, precisely because it was the central foodstuff that went into your body. Now we rely on fossil fuels to give energy to machines to do the labor of humanity. Formerly, before the machine age, we relied on bread to provide calories to people so that they would have the strength to do the labor of humanity. And so bread always had a deeply, a uniquely powerful cultural and religious and symbolic connection to humans.
And I read recently that, you know, a lot less people are eating bread in France and perhaps in Europe as well. But nutritionists are now saying, oh, you know, it's actually really good for you to eat bread and you need to eat bread. You get fiber and stuff. What do you think of that whole Atkins diet and what it did to bread? And are we recovering from that attack?
Yes, we're recovering. I don't think that we were terribly sidetracked during that phase. To me, it was easily dismissed simply because it's verified that Americans are getting fatter, and it's verified that Americans are eating less bread. So how can you blame bread?
France has like a categorization of bread, and there's certain laws and regulations, even like guess in weights and stuff. Do we have that here in America?
Well, weights, we don't have any regulations. In fact, we don't have any requirements for someone to hang a sign out that says bakery. If you were in Germany and you put a sign out that said bakery and you hadn't gone through the procedure to become a certified baker, you would be shut down in an instant. In other words, did you go to school? Did you do your apprenticeship? Did you pass your exams? You have to prove that you can bake. In America, there's no such requirement. I think you might be alluding to regulations that took place in France. I think it's about 10 years ago now. It might be more than that. But basically, if you have a sign that says bakery in France, that means that you are bringing in the raw materials. You're mixing them on the premises. You're not using package mixes. You're not using par-baked dough or frozen dough, and you're baking on the premises. And we have no such regulations here, which is, I'm sure it can be looked at from a lot of perspectives. I would be more inclined to think that it would be a good thing to have that kind of regulation here, that if you say you're a bakery, then that should require that you are actually baking the products that you're selling, and that you're mixing the products.
Is American bread better than, let's say, French bread? Are we really sustaining a good bread culture, so to speak, here in America?
I think it's fair to say that one thing that the French and the Americans have in common is that both countries make the finest bread in the world and the worst bread in the world. It's really, really easy to get horrible bread in France. Even in the middle of Paris, you can get really poor bread. And you can get really, really first-class bread again in France. And in the U.S., it's no secret anymore that America has really excelled on the world stage and has won some really important recognition for the quality of our breads.
And you were a member of a so-called team of Olympic bread bakers.
Yes, it's the Coupe du Monde de la Boulangerie. It's they're 12 countries. Each country sends three bakers to represent that country, and I was the captain of the U.S. team in 1996.
Uh-huh. What about German bread? Is it kind of like misunderstood in this country, or is it just because not too many people know how to make it here?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I think, Jeremy, that it's both. It's misunderstood here, and not too many people know how to make it. And I've scratched my head for a lot of years wondering, since we have such a strong influence from German immigrants in the U.S., I've wondered why the tradition of making really authentic German-style breads has gone away in the U.S. because it's pretty hard to find it. The breads are misunderstood. Oh, well, when we think of rye bread here, it has very little rye. It's probably white rye flour, so it's very lacking in flavor. And often, if not always, it's overloaded with caraway seeds, which really just distort the flavor, too. It's very rare to see caraway seeds in bread in Germany. You might see it on the surface of a loaf where it's part of a seed blend, but caraway in bread is not very common at all. And if you do see it, in all likelihood, it's been ground up before it's added to the dough. The breads in Germany tend to be much more robust, the rye breads in Germany. In fact, it's illegal to call a bread rye bread in Germany unless it has a minimum of 90% rye flour in it. And that's 90% rye flour is a heck of a lot more than you're going to find in most rye breads made in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And do you think anybody's going to start going out and baking after we talk today? Some good German breads?
I think what happens is once you have an opportunity to try them when they're well-made and when you've eaten them correctly, in other words, if you have a bread made with 100% rye, you don't want to have a club sandwich kind of thing, then I think you find that these breads also have their valid place. Now, mind you, they're so completely different from wheat-based breads, but that doesn't negate their validity. I like to think of the proverbial bread basket as being something that's pretty darn big, and as long as a bread is really properly made, respecting the ingredients and the proper procedures to make it, I say put it in the proverbial bread basket, and there's definitely a place for well-made rye breads in that basket. And I think that slowly but surely it's beginning to spread in the U.S. Bakers are getting more competent at making it. That's where it has to start. And then hopefully from there, consumers get more educated as to the proper place of these breads.
Okay. Pain au levain and San Francisco sourdough bread. What's the difference with those two? Aren't they basically the same?
Yes, they're basically the same, but both of those are very, very generic terms. So there's no – if you say – pain au levain, it translates as sourdough bread, mm-hmm. but beyond that, it doesn't necessarily signify much about what that bread's going to taste like. Yes, it's going to be sourdough, but is it going to be mild and sweet-tasting sourdough, or is it going to be a very sharp and acidic sourdough? That's up to, again, the way the baker directs the fermentation and the whole process of the bread making. And San Francisco sourdough, too, you can go to San Francisco and get some truly remarkably bad bread, and you can also get some really, really well-made bread out there. So as a generic term, it's not giving us too much specifics as to what's actually going to be in that bag.
Okay. How can somebody become a good baker without having practiced really for a long time or even had formal training?
We're up against a challenge in the U.S. because we don't have a required apprenticeship program, so there's no formalized schooling that's available. There's little formalized schooling that's available. Certainly here at King Arthur, we've got a very robust and highly skilled baking education center, so we're able to offer people from all ranges of skill, from total beginner to really high-level professional. We're able to offer them a place to come for learning and training. There's some other good schools around the country, but generally speaking, for somebody to say, you know, I'm 18 years old, I don't feel like entering one of the professions, but I do want to learn how to bake, to say, you know, where can I go to school for 2 years in a state-sanctioned school and get not just academic training, but also practical hands-on training. We don't have that, and it's. I think that's really sad because not everyone is going to be cut out to be in, you know, one of the what's called white-collar professions. And it would be great if we could give an opportunity for young people to be moving into baking more.
Is it hard to cut into the baking field and start a business today? Is it harder than maybe opening a restaurant?
I don't know if it's harder than opening a restaurant. I think it's harder to open a bakery today than it was, say, 20 years ago, partially because there's more chain places, so you have more of the au bon pain and Panera bread, that kind of thing, so that makes it a bit harder. People start to associate baked goods with things that are really pretty mediocre, maybe. I think years ago, well, I started the business almost 25 years ago, and it was almost comical at how little it cost to open the doors. I just didn't have any money, so I had to open it on what I had. And just how bare bones everything was. But the goal then for me was, if the product is good, then I'll build a clientele. And they can then, that can help then improve my business. And it was a model that worked back then. Could I do that same thing today if I were the same age and I had the same skill level as I did when I started my shop? That's probably unlikely.
You wrote a really great book on bread baking, and sometimes there's a lot of books that I find that, you know, the formulas will be wrong, or maybe it's baking incorrectly. But are you going to be doing more books, or is this just your Bible that you've written here?
Well, I guess I would describe myself as a baker who wrote a book, not as a book writer who bakes, if you know the distinction I'm trying to make. So I think my motivation for writing the book was, well, it was many, actually. It was I've had the real good fortune of having a work life that's a combination of production baking, which I do 3 weeks a month, and I've always been a production baker for the last 30 years, and for the last several years I've also been an instructor. So being an instructor, it was fairly easy for me to see kind of areas or themes pertaining to baking that seem to be constant stumbling blocks for students, or areas where there seem to be a particularly high amount of misinformation. And that enabled me to focus a lot on where I wanted to try to develop my own understanding of different areas, so that I could hopefully try to write things in a credible way that was clear enough so that it was comprehensible and it was valid information. And so that was my motivation. And to be able to teach made it easier for me to do that, but also to have the opportunity to be baking 3 weeks a month, it was also great because, you know, it just keeps you so current with, literally, with the material.
And your classes are always sold out, so how are we going to be able to go see you and learn how to bake with you?
Well, I did get a fair bit of recognition in this little world of baking for the book that I wrote, and so there's a bit of sun shining on me right now, but I'm sure the classes aren't going to be sold out, you know, all the time, because somebody else is going to write a great book. I mean, that was also another thing that I was hoping when I wrote that book, was that it would just be a book that would be a contribution, and it would bring the world of baking books a little bit further along, and that would therefore just enable, you know, the next evolution of bread books to surpass the book that I wrote, so that we keep on getting better and better and more valid information and that sort of thing. So there'll be somebody else out there who's going to write a book, and the sun is going to start shining on them.
Great. Yeah, because I've been kind of spreading the gospel to my friends and some websites in England and Australia, and one of those guys is Dan Lepard, who we interviewed before. And I'm hoping to get you guys together one day to do something, because Dan's a really great influence on my baking now.
Mm.
His methods are, you know, really, I'm sure, great for professional bakers, but for home bakers, he gives a different, really, an insight on how to bake and what you're looking for, and to really feel and sense what bread is. And it's a living thing, and enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's made quite a good contribution, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I don't want to keep for too long a time, because you've been up a lot longer than I have. But I appreciate talking to you, and hopefully I'll be able to get up to Vermont and take some of your courses.
Well, that would be wonderful. I hope you can do that, Jeremy.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, too.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.